From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Animals, they're everywhere. Squirrels dash around in our backyards. Pigeons leave unwelcome presents on the windshields of our cars. And cats and dogs fall all over themselves to greet us when we come home. We share a planet with animals, but just how deep does the connection go? Veterinarian Alan Schoen would bet the farm that animals and people are kindred spirits.
What I'm finding is veterinarians, animal lovers, animal caretakers all over the place are recognizing that, hey, let's wake up. We're all talking together. We're all connected. We truly are all one. Why keep on trying to put these divisions between us?
And speaking of veterinarians, later this hour we'll renew old friendships with Siegfried, Tristan, and, of course, James Herriot. But first, claiming culture for animals. Franz De Waal is a primatologist and author of The Ape and the Sushi Master. He says humans are very much mistaken if they think they're the only ones who have culture. De Waal defines culture as a kind of learning which is passed on from one animal to another. It's got a lot in common with the way an apprentice learns to make sushi by watching a sushi master for years. De Waal told Steve Paulson this kind of animal culture was spotted years ago when a Japanese macaque named Emo began washing sweet potatoes on Koshima Island.
One young monkey had started to wash sweet potatoes to clean them, bring them to the water and clean them, and then later bring them to the ocean and clean them and salt them, they would say. They gave it a certain taste. So they discovered that, that Emo was doing that, and that very shortly after Emo had started this, her mom was doing it, and then later her peers were doing it. And within 5 years, half the group was doing it. And within 10 years, I think almost everyone, except for the older males. The older males were most reluctant to learn anything new, as we may recognize also, I suppose. And so that was the story of Koshima Island. And it became this story on animal culture for a long time until it was questioned later on. But it is still the dominant story, I think.
And you would say that this is an example, once this practice of washing potatoes spread throughout the macaques, this is an example of culture in the animal world.
Well, usually we call it a tradition. So a tradition is behavior that is transmitted by behavioral means, by learning and observation, not by genetic means. Now, more recently, we have introduced terms such as culture and cultural learning, and that's because in some species, such as, for example, the chimpanzee, you find entire sets of traditions. So it's not just an isolated little tradition like potato washing. More recently, an article came out, for example, a year ago in Nature, where 7 field sites were compared, and they found 39 different behavior patterns that were variable across the field sites. And so basically the field workers, if you give them a videotape of chimpanzees doing something, eating nuts or eating ants or something, they will be able to tell you where that video was taken just on the basis of the behavior. In the same way that I can show you a video of French people at work or German people at work, and you will be able to tell the difference.
Give me an example of how behaviors vary from one group of chimpanzees to another.
Well, there's some chimp groups where they have particular communication gestures. So, for example, they clasp their hands when they're grooming, or they rip leaves apart in order to draw the attention of the opposite sex and stuff like that. There are others where you have nut cracking. They use stone tools to crack nuts, and whereas the neighboring groups may have similar stones and similar nuts but not be doing much with them. You have different kinds of ant fishing. So, for example, chimps poke with a stick into an anthill or a termite hill and then retrieve the insects. But in some groups, they use long sticks and retrieve a lot of them at the same time. In other ones, they use short sticks and retrieve them one by one, basically. And so they have different eating styles in the same way that you would have, let's say, some eat with knife and fork and the other ones eat with chopsticks or something like that.
And you're saying what makes these various activities cultural is that they're learned and they're passed among the chimps who live together.
Yeah, in fact, cultural learning, we think now, is extremely widespread. And so the image of animals doing their species-typical things and being stuck with their instincts, so to speak, is apparently completely wrong, because you have so much variability within the same species or across time within the same species. So, for example, it's not only from one location to the other, but more recently there was a report on whales having changed their song in the ocean. So all the whales are singing a particular song, and the next year, maybe because of one very successful singer that everyone's to emulate, everyone is singing a different tune.
And yet what's so interesting is that for years, for centuries, it's been assumed that only people have culture, that this is something that animals couldn't do. And I know there has been resistance, or there probably still is resistance among scientists to the idea that animals, even primates, have culture.
Yeah, I have speculated, and the book is called The Ape and the Sushi Master, because I'm doing a lot of comparisons between Western and Eastern science and Western and Eastern approaches, and so that's a little bit reflected in the name. And I went to Japan and China to explore the concept of culture and the opinions about it. And I think it's not accidental that the animal culture concept came to us from the East. And the reason is that in the West, we have a very strong tendency to be dualistic. We have for a long time divorced the mind from the brain, which we don't do anymore, but that's still very much a trend. Humans from animals, definitely, that's another dualism. And culture sort of took a very important part in that dualism. When we didn't use the word soul anymore to distinguish us from animals and we went with more scientific terminology, the term culture sort of adopted the same meaning. Like, we have culture. We are by definition cultural creatures. Animals are by definition natural creatures. Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist, even would speak of a transition. We transcended nature, we left nature behind, and we moved into the cultural domain. Now, the Eastern people don't think like that at all, and so Japanese primatology from the beginning had absolutely no trouble with thinking that animals might have culture. It's now widely adopted by many Western scientists, obviously. It's a big topic, becoming a big topic in the Western sciences as well. But I don't think it's accidental that it came from elsewhere.
Do you think a lot of people are still threatened by this idea that animals do in fact have culture?
Well, you would think that the biggest opposition to the idea would come from cultural anthropologists. After all, the word culture is what they introduced, and they made hundreds of definitions. There's actually a review article of 250 definitions of the way culture has been defined. So you would think that the cultural anthropologists would be all in arms against us, but they're not. Because in their discipline, culture has become a messy concept. They have become postmodern. They don't know what evidence is anymore, so to speak. Scientific evidence. They're fighting with each other about what to do in their science. And so the resistance to the idea of animal culture has not come from them, but has come from psychologists, learning psychologists, who are used to doing very controlled experiments on learning in the lab. They focus very much on the mechanism of transmission. So they will argue such things as, if it is not full-fledged imitation, we will not call it culture. Now, most of the primatologists, such as myself, cannot agree with that. I am trained as a biologist, and in biology, we never define anything by the mechanism. So, for example, let's say locomotion. Locomotion is a term we use for many animals, whether they fly or swim or walk or crawl. We don't care. We call it all locomotion. We have always these broader definitions. And in the same way, the primatologists have argued that we should define culture very broadly. And then how it is achieved, that's a secondary question. It's an interesting question that we should address, and the learning psychologist can contribute greatly to that question, but they shouldn't a priori or set boundaries that exclude the animal.
And to some degree, you're saying that it really doesn't matter whether a mother chimp sits down and teaches her baby how to do something or whether the baby picks it up just by watching the mother.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. The point is that you learn something from someone else that you might not have learned on your own. Now, how you do that is secondary. It is, of course, interesting if mothers teach their offspring. And there is some very limited evidence for teaching, active teaching in animals. It is not nearly convincing enough to convince the skeptics such as these learning psychologists. But, for example, there are killer whales around the waters of Argentina that hunt sea lions by stranding themselves and grabbing a sea lion and then going back into the ocean. It's a very dangerous technique for a whale to do because they could end up stranded. So there are indications that the mother killer whales, they take their kids to empty beaches where there are no sea lions, and they teach them how to strand themselves. So they push them in the direction of the beach. The kid strands itself. If it cannot get back into the ocean, the mother makes wash with her tail so that they flow back into the ocean. And so it seems to be a teaching experience geared towards the hunting technique that they have developed. Now, if this is true, it is, of course, very hard to do any experiment in the lab on a killer whale. That's not going to happen. But if this is true, this story, and there's some indications for chimpanzees as well, we would have active instruction, which would make it even more similar to human cultural transmission.
What about the rest of the animal world? Is there much indication that that other animals have culture?
Well, whether they have culture in the sense that they have entire sets of traditions, that's something else. But whether there's cultural learning, as we call it, that means transmission of knowledge and habits through observation, that's for sure in many animals. And so, for example, songbirds are very well known that they have dialects that change from region to region that are transmitted from adult males to younger males. There's many other animals. I heard, for example, that the bears in U.S. wildlife parks have all sorts of techniques of getting at food. And so that in some parks, some bears have discovered that certain cars, if you jump on top of them, the doors pop open and you can get at the food. And they seem to be transmitting that sort of knowledge, because once it is established in a park, then all the bears apparently start doing the same thing. And so cultural learning may actually be very widespread if we start looking at it. And thus far, we have looked at it mainly in the primates and in the sea mammals. But I'm sure we're going to find it much, much more widespread. And songbirds are a very good example where people have used the word cultural learning for a very long time.
What's at stake in these debates that we've been discussing about trying to figure out how much culture animals have? Why does this matter, this whole question?
Well, I think it matters greatly, because I'm very much objecting to the split that we have made between, let's say, the sciences that deal with humans, such as psychology, sociology, politicology, economics, and so on. All these sciences deal with human behavior. And the sciences that deal with animal behavior, which is mainly biology and maybe learning psychology. What I feel we need is a single science for behavior. Behavior in all creatures is extremely complex. Humans are not a lot more complex. They're a little bit more complex than most other animals. Certain things we can be proud of, and so the human ego is involved in some ways in all of this. I understand that. But we need a single science for behavior, because behavior is basically very similar across many species. And so I'm objecting in this book to the artificial split that we have created between humans and other animals, and use the culture issue as one of these issues, because that's often what comes up when you say, well, we're actually quite similar to animals. People will say, but we have culture and animals don't. And so it is an important issue, because it reflects back on how we place ourselves in the natural world.
Frans de Waal is the author of The Ape and the Sushi Master, Cultural Reflections of a Primatologist. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Can you name this animal? Easy, right? They're elephants. Now, try this one. If you said elephants again, you're right. Dave Soldier is a neurologist at Columbia University. He's also the maestro of a rather unusual ensemble, the Thai Elephant Orchestra. Soldier collaborated with scientist Richard Lehrer to build elephant-sized instruments and teach six young elephants in Thailand the joy of music. The result is a CD Soldier produced for Melotta Records, and Strange Champs wondered about one track called Temple Music.
It started with one elephant named Leucope playing something which is sort of like a bass guitar. I call it a diddly bow after Bo Diddley, and also diddly bow was the name of the instrument that he chose his name from. and then it was followed by a harmonica-like instrument, which is called a cane, which is possibly the ancestor for the European organ, and it's a instrument that's played in eastern Thailand in the region called Isan, which is quite close, but not the same as where the elephants are living.
Can you tell me more about the elephants? You mentioned a few of their names. Did you spend enough time with them that you began to get a sense of their personalities and which kind of instruments they would prefer?
It's pretty striking. And, you know, it was a big surprise for all of us. Some of them take to some instruments a lot faster than others. Some of them prefer one over the other. I mentioned Jojo. Jojo's Mahout, the person that he lives with all the time and is, you know, the person that takes care of him. His name is Samnuk, and Samnuk, I think, is from Isan, and he plays that instrument, the cane. And everybody thought that Jojo would like to play the cane, but he doesn't exactly like to play the cane. He likes to play chimes and bells and marimbas and things like that. Luke Hope is definitely a drummer, and there's a young one named Poon, and Poon just loves to play the marimba. Hmm. And he doesn't seem to like playing the other ones quite so much. There's one named Chapati, who is the only Israeli elephant. He was born in an Israeli zoo, and when he got big enough, they said, hey, he should be with other elephants, and they moved him to Thailand. And he loves playing the bass guitar.
Hmm. Let's listen to another track. There's one I really like a lot, harmonica music. I really like it myself because it's very moving to me to be able to hear the elephant's breath actually producing a sound. That, to me, is really amazing. But let's listen to a bit. And what's the drum in the background?
It's a bass drum. It's like the drum you'd use in a marching band.
Mm-hmm. And were those just harmonicas, or was that also the cane?
I think those are two harmonicas and a pitch pipe, like the kind you'd use to tune a ukulele.
Can you tell me anything?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing that you notice there is that the elephant's breath is so long. You know, they hold out the notes a lot longer than, you know, Bob Dylan or somebody.
There's also a kind of quality of, maybe I'm anthropomorphizing, but it sounded as though the elephants were enjoying it. I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't, but it just that you could hear them letting the breath all the way out and then pulling it all the way back in and really sort of having fun with what sound they would make.
The story, maybe you read this, but I was coming into the jungle, the story I tell. I mean, I came to the jungle at 6 a.m. one day. It was the day after I gave the elephants harmonicas, and the elephants at night stay way out in the jungle where they feed. They're brought there at sunset, and they only sleep about 4 hours, and then the rest of the time they're out there eating the jungle vegetation. And they come in the morning around 6 o'clock, and I thought I was hallucinating because I heard harmonicas all over the place. I heard one crossing the river and another one way up on the hill and another one in the path and all playing at the same time. But it was the elephants walking in and playing harmonicas as they were walking in the woods. So, I really wish I had recorded that, although I probably wouldn't have made such a good recording because the sounds were so distant. But it was an amazing thing because I really thought I was hallucinating at the beginning. It was a beautiful sound.
Do elephants get better or change in the way they play or get better at their instruments as time goes by? You know, the way a child gets better at playing piano or whatever?
Sure. Yeah, they do. They often will start off hitting the instrument at, you know, a number of different places, and then they'll find the place where it sounds the best, and they'll keep hitting it there. And again, the current star of the orchestra is definitely Luke Hope, and he's a boy. He's about eight years old, and he's kind of a troublemaker, but he really loves playing the drums, and now he's playing. The last time I was there about 2 months ago, his drum set now has evolved to two bass drums and three cymbals, and he can alternate easily between the two bass drums, going boom, 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 and then hitting the cymbals in the same tempo, and without, you know, instruction, and he'll go boom, 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 So his technique has really come a long way.
Dave Soldier, speaking with Ann Strainchamps about the Thai Elephant Orchestra. All proceeds from their CD go to benefit a milk bank for orphaned elephants. Hemingway was crazy for it. Animal rights activists are appalled by it, and crowds of people crave it every day. The beastly beauty of the bullfight, coming up later this hour. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Did you ever catch your dog or your cat staring at you and think just for a moment that they were trying to talk to you? Maybe they are. Alan Schoen is a veterinarian and the author of Kindred Spirits, How the Remarkable Bond Between Humans and Animals Can Change the Way We Live. He says the lives of humans and animals are much more closely entwined than we think. His own life was changed forever by his dog, Megan.
Megan was one of my greatest teachers, and she was this golden retriever stray that a friend of mine brought to me that she was collapsing and coughing. And back then in New England, a dog with those signs usually ended up being diagnosed with heartworm disease. During the recovery stage, there's a six-week period where they need to be very quiet. And so I took her with me to make sure she was quiet, and I noticed she started watching me as I would minister to a cow or a lamb or a dog or a cat or a ferret, whatever. And after that period of time, she ended up coming with me on all my calls even after she recovered. And what I noticed was that she would go over to the person or the animal that needed the most love while I was administering my Western medicine. For instance, one cold winter blustery night in New Hampshire, where she and I were going over Temple Mountain to help deliver a calf with a cow that had milk fever. And we went into the classic old red barn with the cobwebs all over and went through, and there was a cow laying there with milk fever or calcium deficiency. Mm-hmm. And I went ahead and started doing a physical exam that administering fluids and everything. She immediately went over to the farmer's daughter who was there all crying because she was so attached to this one particular cow. And she started licking her tears, and she just started cuddling up to this little girl. Then once I started getting the cow stabilized and started delivering the calf, she ran over to the anxious cow and started licking her face. And then once the calf came out, she started licking the calf. And on the way back that night, I asked her, I said, "Megan, is this just your genetic, hereditary, maternal instinct being a golden retriever and female? Or have you consciously evolved to a different level where, after watching me for so long, you've adapted to this?"
You've got a couple of things going on here. Megan seems to be an unusual animal, but unusual in both her empathy for other creatures and for her apparent understanding of what it is that you want.
Yes, here's one theory that I propose, okay, based on the latest research in brain development in animals and based on the latest research in what is called the molecules of emotion, where all the research had been done on animals but extrapolated to people. What I'm doing is bringing it back to the animals, that Megan, as an example, is one that saw many things that I was doing, incorporated them, learned them, and started exhibiting them, these behaviors, to help other animals. Now, some people would say, okay, she saw something, learned it, and it's all just learned behavior. And whether it's learned behavior it's time to go beyond the concept of trying to differentiate between humans and animals, where we can integrate it in a different way. There's so much evidence now that animals do have consciousness, that they do make choices based on their life experiences. And just like with us, the classic nature-nurture controversy, what part of who we are is our genes and what part is our environmental nurturing?
The learned behavior thing is almost understandable. It fits in with our notion of what is possible in the relationship between humans and animals. The more spiritual side of this thing is more difficult, I think, for us all to accept. But you had another example, a young boy who came in with a dog who had degenerative myelopathy?
Correct.
And it seemed to be a direct connection between boy and dog.
It was interesting. You know, at one level, it's very understandable again. You know, the boy was suffering from Lyme disease that hadn't been properly diagnosed and then had to go on intravenous antibiotics. But during the time, he was in bed, just about paralyzed, debilitated from the Lyme disease, and the dog was slowly deteriorating with weakness too. So when they first came into my office, a very distraught mother was walking the dog in. Behind her, this dog was dragging his hind legs, and behind the dog was Scott on crutches from recovering from Lyme. And during that period of time, we were treating the dog, and it ended up, I didn't feel it had degenerative myelopathy. It had that as one component, but it also had arthritis in its hips and back and ended up developing Lyme disease as well. So we were treating all these different things with a combination of conventional medicine, acupuncture, herbs, and we found that the dog, King, gradually recovered. And at the same time, Scott was gradually recovering. And what Scott noticed was when the dog would do worse, he would do worse. When he would do worse, the dog would do worse. And their recovery paralleled each other. Now, again, what happens is there's certainly an emotional connection. There's an impact of animals reading our feelings and us reading their feelings. But what I think happens beyond that is this connection goes so much deeper. I kept on hearing clients talking about this deeper connection. And my left brain scientific mind said, oh, it's just learned behavior. But over 20 years of veterinary practice, I started seeing whether I was treating a horse, a dog, a ferret, a lamb, whatever. Clients wanted to talk about this feeling of a deeper connection with all of life. And finally, I started saying, hey, let's take a look at that. Let's see if what part we can explain scientifically based on known science and what part is a more, say, psycho-spiritual connection.
Can I ask you what the response of the veterinary community is to this kind of a feeling? I mean, this isn't something that you were taught in veterinary school to expect, was it?
Oh, definitely not. At that point, there was even people would question you if animals felt pain or not. There was still the model of Descartes to think, therefore I am. Now we've, as over the last 10 years with the great research showing that we have the same neurotransmitters, the same molecules of emotion, we have the same brain, it's all just differences in gradation. We're acknowledging that animals do feel pain, they do feel emotions, they do have thought. However, you know, again, veterinarians in general, we're trained very scientifically to only believe something if there's a double-blind study. But once you're in practice for a long time, you realize there's a lot that isn't documented, and lack of evidence does not mean lack of efficacy. And more veterinarians I find are wanting to talk about this. It's funny, whenever I teach at different veterinary schools or conferences, veterinarians will take me aside and say, hey, let's have lunch or let's have dinner. He goes, I'm so glad you're talking about this. This is something I feel, but we're scared to talk about it being ridiculed.
Can I just ask you a question? I mean, you've been a practicing vet for 20 years. Is there a chance, do you think, that having treated so many sick animals, you want this to be true and so you're seeing it?
I think the mind is a very powerful tool that can be used in many different ways. And yes, I think if one wants to be absolutely skeptical, that if you want to see a deeper connection, you can see it. But does that mean it's not there, or does that mean it's there? You know, it's kind of like someone who goes out and looks for a new dog, or say goes and looks thinking about purchasing a new car, and then all of a sudden you see it everywhere. It's this kind of epiphany or eureka moment that all of a sudden you're saying, oh my gosh, I see these connections, these communications everywhere. And it's kind of like also, we tend to be so species-centric that we demand that our animal friends speak English. But as soon as we start realizing that they're speaking to us in dog or horse or cat, and they're speaking with, you know, like cats have been documented to have over 25 vocalizations, and we start associating them with what they're talking about and their body language and everything like that, we realize, hey, we need to talk cat or dog or whatever. And once you start seeing these connections, it becomes self-evident. It's like what I'm finding is veterinarians, animal lovers, animal caretakers all over the place are recognizing that, hey, let's wake up. We're all talking together. We're all connected. We truly are all one. Why keep on trying to put these divisions between us?
There is a story in your book about the orcas who gave a kind of salute at the funeral of another whale. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. That story I throw in the book as a real stretch, saying, okay, you know, if we acknowledge that there's this mental connection, there's this emotional connection, there's this genetic connection, all of these, what about some deeper connections that we can't quite explain yet? And this was a story takes place in the San Juan Islands between Seattle and Vancouver, where there are three pods of orca whales that are resident pods. They live there normally. And they've been studied by marine biologists there for over 30 years. And one of the whales, called Ralph, they know each whale by name and by markings and by number. And Ralph died at 42 years of age. And the marine biologists decided to give a memorial service at one of the parks on the island where the whales normally can be seen. But the pods hadn't been seen there for a while, and the pods only get together three or four times a year. They're not sure exactly why, if it's for interbreeding or whatever. But just as they were giving this memorial service, Ralph, who was the environmentalist that Ralph the whale was named after, Ralph was saying, let's have a moment of silence. And right at that very moment, all three pods showed up. And one after another, led by J-Pod, which was Ralph's pod, and Ralph's pod was led by a whale that was Ralph's sister. And one by one, they breached, leaping out of the water, and it was almost like this whale funeral procession. And these marine biologists or scientists, their jaws just dropped. And what I question there is, if that was a coincidence, what were the odds of that being a coincidence? If it wasn't a coincidence, then what was that?
I don't think we have an answer.
You know, once we start looking, it's again just a level of perception. Once we start looking at these connections, many animal behaviorists, many veterinarians I talk to say, you know, we see things like this all the time that we can't quite explain. But just because we can't find a scientific explanation right now does not mean that they don't exist.
Alan Schoen is the author of Kindred Spirits. He says animals help make us better people, and society should take that into account for a more compassionate 21st century.
All God's creatures got a place in the choir. Some sing low, some sing higher, some sing out loud on the telephone wire. Others clap their hands or paws or anything they got. Now all God's creatures got a place in the choir. Some sing low, some sing higher, some sing out loud on the telephone wire. Others clap their hands or paws or anything they got.
Coming up, remembering the man who put veterinarians on the map and made a little village in Yorkshire seem like home. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning, I was in Glasgow, out of college and out of work. And tonight, I'm in Yorkshire, and in a job. I'm very grateful.
Not at all. Do you know, if you hadn't found that infected spot in the mare's hoof, or if you hadn't gone back to that cow after she'd shaken hands, you'd be in Yorkshire, but still out of a job.
Well, thank you anyway, Mr. Farnham.
Siegfried's the name.
Siegfried.
A scene from the BBC's All Creatures Great and Small, based on the books by James Herriot, the world's best-loved vet. Herriot's real life wasn't exactly like the story we know. For one thing, his real name was Alf White. He took the name Herriot from a local soccer player. Jim White writes about his father in the biography The Real James Herriot, A Memoir of My Father. White told me his dad's job as assistant veterinarian with Siegfried Farnham wasn't his first. In fact, he learned some unforgettable lessons from an earlier employer, a wise old country vet named Mac.
Farmers had been trying to calve this heifer for several hours and get the calf out, and they couldn't. And Mac sent my dad out to calve the thing, and my father did it in minutes. But he got no thanks from the farmers at all, and he went back to Mac. He's very upset about this. And Mac said, well, you know, they've been on it for hours and you only took minutes. You know, you've made them look a bit silly. Maybe you got it out a bit too quick. And he said, you know, they're paying good money for this sort of thing. You know, don't make things look too easy, he said to my father. And Mac said, I can assure you many times when I've been trying to get calves out of cows, the sweat's been pouring off me holding the bloody things in. So that was a thing that my father never forgot, because he used to tell all the assistants that came through our practice in Thirsk, it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. That's the important thing.
You've found this useful in your own practice in the years since.
Oh, we've listened. Life, as you know, is a great learning curve. As my dad said to me, I don't care how many years you've been qualified as a veterinarian, a day never goes by that you learn something fresh, you know. And we certainly learned a lot with Mac.
Yeah. Now, the practice, of course, that everybody knows about is the one with the man who in the books is known as Siegfried Farnan. His real name was Donald Sinclair. Was he like Siegfried at all?
Very much so. Very much so. And James Herriot really portrayed him very accurately, very, very, very well. Siegfried was a very complex character, but above all, he was a likable character. Mm-hmm. And very difficult at times, as I've said in my book. I think I've been very fair to Siegfried. I've brought out his good points as well as his not-so-good ones. But he's when he died, he's been very, very badly missed. He was one of life's true characters.
Now, there were some of the stories that you tell in your book that didn't make it into the ones that your father wrote, stories about Siegfried. There was one about some hot bones, if I remember.
Well, you must remember the hot bones, of course, is one that my father told me a long time after his books had been published. And when he told me this story, I said, why do you put that in books, Dad? He said, no, I can't do that. It'll upset Donald far too much. And he would deny it anyway. Donald would have denied it.
Yeah. Can you just tell us the story?
A woman came to have her dog put to sleep, and in those days, when you put the dog to sleep, there was difficulty disposing of the body. Nowadays, everything's fine. We have cremation service, we have refrigeration. Everything's done absolutely correctly. But in those days, the poor little dogs were just picked up and taken by disposal men and chucked on heaps and all sorts of things. There was none of the rules and regulations there are now. And so, what happened was the lady came back after 2 or 3 weeks. She asked what had happened to her little dog, and Donald suddenly appeared and said, oh, he was cremated, madam. And she said, oh, that's fine, because I'd like the ashes. And of course, he wasn't cremated at all. He was on a heap somewhere. And Donald immediately said, yes, you shall have some. And in those days, Donald kept pigs down at the bottom of the garden, and he used to have an old boiler where they used to boil up swill to feed the pigs. And at the bottom of the boiler, old bones and ash used to collect. And Donald shot down to the bottom of the old garden and with a dustpan and came back with these ashes. And the lady was there with a velvet cloth waiting to put the ashes in. Donald poured the ashes in the cloth. Suddenly the lady threw the cloth in the air. There was smoke, there was fumes all over the room. The ashes were still hot. The little dog had been dead 3 weeks, but his ashes were still hot. But that was typical of Siegfried, that sort of thing.
What was the response of the people in the community once they began to read your father's books? Did they see themselves in the books?
One or two of them did, and very few of them objected. In fact, I don't think any of them objected. Mrs. Pumphrey was a famous character he wrote about, with a little Pekingese called Tricky Woo.
All of a sudden, right out of the blue, Tricky went crack-a-dog, running around in circles, hysterically barking and yelping in the most peculiar fashion. Then suddenly, down he went on his side, just like a dead thing. I was beside myself, Mr. Herriot.
I feel sure you must have been.
And then the next thing, up he gets again, apparently perfectly normal.
I see. And how has he been since?
Fine.
Now, Mrs. Pumphrey was a little bit put out. The real lady called Miss Warner. And she wrote a letter to my father and said, you should be careful, you know, what you say about people and this sort of thing. But in really, she didn't really mind too much because she came over as a very nice lady. Mm-hmm. But that was the only... He just got a little bit of a finger-wagging with that one. But most of the farmers that recognised themselves, to be quite honest, they were pleased. They were quite chuffed with the way they'd been portrayed by my dad, although he was terrified of them finding out. I don't think he need have been so.
Did he have a favourite kind of... a favourite part of the practice? Were there things that he liked better about veterinary practice than others?
He was basically, fundamentally, a large animal farm veterinarian. And his favourite animals, without a doubt, were the cows, was the cattle side of the practice. That was his, what he always used to say, was his bread and butter.
Did you get to go along with him as he was out on his calls?
Oh, I was all over the place with him in the car. In those days, you'd think nothing of doing 9 or 10 or even 12 calls in a morning to farms, maybe another 12 in the afternoon, and plenty at night. This was very exciting for me. Nowadays, vets were stuck indoors. We're treating dogs and cats, or we're stuck in places like abattoirs and meat factories and all these sort of things. It's a different life, totally different life. And for kids, it's not as exciting. But for me, driving about the farms, I knew all the farmers, I knew all the kids, play with the kids. I knew which, I drove about in the farmers' tractors, used to fight with the kids on the haystacks. Oh, it was a great life. But it's different now.
Yeah.
My kids, not one of my kids want to be a vet, not one of them. They were bored when they came round with me. It was too clinical. In the old days, it was more adventure.
Do you miss those days? You wish you could go out on a call to a farmer's yard now?
We still do. But they're fewer and far between. And the family farms are on my... I live in a little village not far from Thirsk here in Yorkshire. And the small family farms are disappearing by the month. They're all going out. And farming is having a terrible time here in the United Kingdom. We've had a very bad time. And we're seeing the farms disappearing. And my father's books, of course... As I tell everybody, that's a way of life that's gone. It's history, both for the veterinarian and the farmer. But I was lucky. I qualified in the 60s, and I got a taste of the life that the vet used to have. It's still a great profession, don't get me wrong. It's a terrific profession, and it has to move with the times. But all professions are changing, aren't they?
Jim White is taking some time off from the practice these days to write. He's the author of The Real James Herriot. Animals can be our companions or our vocation, and of course, our nourishment. The relationship gets even more complex in Spain, where bullfighting is enjoying a huge surge in popularity. A.L. Kennedy writes about the phenomenon in her new book On Bullfighting. She told Steve Paulson that bullfight aficionados venerate the kill. When a great matador like Ponce takes the animal's life, it's a primal and powerful form of worship.
There are certain people at certain times who will love something so much that they have to harm it. There are certain people at certain times who will love it so much that they have to defend it to the end. There is certainly an element of that within the bullfight. I mean, it wouldn't have lasted so long, this whole kind of strange relationship between a man and an animal, or men and this particular species wouldn't have lasted so long, if it didn't have something quite fundamental going on in it.
Does a Spanish bullfight always end with the killing of the bull?
It's very, very rare that the bull is pardoned if a bull behaves with extraordinary courage to the point where they want to save it to breed from it. It will be pardoned and gets an indultado, but, I mean, that's fantastically rare. Normally the bull is killed, yeah.
Now, I'm guessing that for most Americans, it would be hard to hop a flight to Spain and watch a bullfight without seeing it as something horrific. I know you're from Scotland. Did you find it hard to watch a bullfight?
No, but I mean, that's to do with my personality. It's not to do with being Scottish, because we don't do it either. And certainly Britain is, it's very hard to research the book because Britain is seen as the land of the RSPCA, which is like your humane society. There's a lot of racism about that. There's just a distrust of Europe and a distrust of Spanish people. But there is also a dislike of an activity which involves 15 minutes of kind of ritualized torture ending in death.
Well, there's also a whole mystique about bullfighting that I suppose for many Americans goes back to Hemingway. But you are quite dismissive about Hemingway and bullfighting.
Well, a lot of aficionados were quite dismissive of Hemingway because he technically gets things wrong, and this is the occupation for people who have to get things exactly right. You have to identify the pass absolutely accurately. The foot has to be at such an angle to your body and not any other angle. And I think that the machismo that he brings to it is kind of, I suppose, slightly boorish for a lot of Spanish aficionados. And there is the whole kind of thing that he's being so macho because he basically wants to hang out with injured bullfighters and stroke their thighs, which is a little strange, particularly when they're injured. It's unsanitary. So it's kind of, you're reading that. And I mean, you know, some of his best writing was the bullfighting writing, and then he came back when he was kind of past his best and just drinking a hell of a lot, and it's some of his worst writing too. So, I mean, his love was perhaps not terribly kind to the sport sometimes.
Can you briefly walk me through a bullfight? What happens when the bull enters the ring?
As an observer, the first thing you would notice is probably that the bull can be terribly beautiful. It does thunder. It does snort. It does paw the ground. It does look like hell on wheels. It's quite, I mean, they're not always black and glossy, but they can be. They're a beautiful animal. Once you become familiar with the sort of etiquette of the bullfight, you realize that the livelier and the more powerful the bull is, the more it will be punished in the stages that you go through to bring it to the last passage with the matador. You then have the bull will be weakened in two sections. The picador will come in. They stand up on their toes, run in, and place two kind of the plumed sticks that you see into this kind of hump behind on the sort of shoulders that the bull has.
But what you're basically saying is that the bull is speared by various people before it ever faces the matador with the cape. So this is a seriously wounded bull by the time of its final confrontation.
Yeah, I mean, what you'll get is a man on horseback, the picador, whoever everybody boos, will literally put a spear into the back of the bull 2, 3, 4, 5 times. That really saps its strength.
It's not a very fair fight, is it?
No, it's not. The bull, as I say, is not getting out alive. It's not like a rodeo or something. What it comes down to right at the end is the faena, which is meant to be the heart of the bullfight. The bull is meant to be sort of aplombado, which is slower, but not impossibly slow. The matador is there with the small cape, the muleta, and he's making arguably the most artistic passes. He's getting close enough for the bull's blood to be kind of painted across his body as they move together, and they appear to dance together. Actually, the matador is making moves that make the bull move. I mean, obviously, they aren't dancing. But you'll see the matador sometimes talking to the bull. There'll be this... You begin to see a relationship, that there's a tension between the two, that there is some kind of communication between the two, although obviously the bull is in immense pain, is obviously bleeding a great deal. The matador is going to kill it, however sort of kind and communicative he looks.
You have a passage in your book about the great matador, Enrique Ponce. Could you read it for us?
Yeah. Panther takes the bull away from its injury, its distress, dances it towards its death. And I understand why, beneath the banal sexuality of the skin-tight silk, there is something sexual about the finer. When the paso doble kicks in again, when Panther lets his arms open, tosses back his head, and simply walks with enough presence to touch 14,000 people, he brings himself into a space he has created where one living creature seems to entirely anticipate the physical will of another. To humanize, this preparation for a death can look like a place of safety, a place where our needs are unfolded for us, where we can transcend ourselves, not alone. Every time the bull falters or stalls, Panther stays with it, closer and closer, the animal's blood slowly painting the front of his traje. No one in the world but them, no one in the world but us, because he has sighted us too, drawn us into the inexorable movement towards his goal, the kill. Panther fetches the sword, makes the last loaded passes in faultless silence, and then darts in. Something buckles in the air, blinks, and then there is applause, while the bull sways and its legs fold under it. Panther watches, arm extended, his whole body braced in the air, the finer not over until the last breath, until he takes the toro's life. Which is as close as I've known the corrida to get to religious experience, the sight of man willing in, taking in an animal's life. It is a strange thing to watch, an elaborately prepared transgression, a sacrifice and a sin, ugly and peculiarly moving.
A.L. Kennedy is the author of On Bullfighting. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program 325B, Animals Among Us. You can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or email us through our web address, www.wpr.org/book. It's always nice to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.